This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative. Today, I'm so excited to be talking with Dr. Brashani Reese, who is the ED of DROP LWAP, which stands for Life Without Parole, which is an advocacy, community building, and educational nonprofit with the goal of ending life without parole sentences in New England. Let me tell you just a bit about DROP LWAP before we begin our conversation with Dr. Reese. DROP LWAP's website lists their core beliefs, which I'm going to quote because I think they're simple, they're straightforward, and they really resonate. We believe in ending LWAP, the death penalty, and all forms of extreme punishment. We believe that these sentences do not bring healing or accountability. We believe in supporting opportunities for every incarcerated person to return to the community. Dr. Reese is a trained restorative justice practitioner and holds a doctorate in clinical psychology with concentrations in forensics and children and families. And she's currently, as I said, the ED of DROP LWAP. Welcome to the show, Dr. Reese. So glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start by asking you about yourself, your background, what brought you to the work of fighting against extreme sentences in New England. This is a hard hill to climb and requires lots of different efforts in lots of different directions. So why this? Why you?
So how much time do you have?
27 minutes.
It goes all the way back for me many years. As a young woman, I am actually a survivor of attempted murder. So this is where it all begins. I became up close and personal with the criminal justice system for the first time as a survivor of attempted murder. So I had no idea what I was in for, what it was about. But when I first walked in right away, I knew that I didn't want prison. This person who had attempted to take my life was at the time a romantic partner. And I knew that he needed help. And quite honestly, I knew that I needed help too, because I had somehow landed in a situation where I'm, you know, being attacked by my romantic partner. And I knew that this was a dynamic that was unfolding. And I inherently knew that violence was a part of a context. So I had asked the people who were helping me through this court process for an alternative to a trial, incarceration, whatnot. And I was pretty much laughed out of that room because I was assured that I would feel so much better once the monster, and I'm using air quotes, was put away for as many years as possible, because this is a dangerous, awful person and the solution is just to put him in a cage for a really long time, and that I was going to feel much better after that. And even as a young person, I just understood that that wasn't going to be the case. I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to ask him, did he understand the impact that he had had on my life through those actions? So, of course, putting him in a cage did not bring me any sort of healing. It did not deal with the consequences of being a survivor in that way. It didn't deal with my PTSD reactions, my post-traumatic stress reactions, waking up in the middle of the night, holding my breath because I thought that I was being killed. It didn't deal with the financial consequences because I almost lost my job. I had a hard time continuing on with my life just as if everything was normal. And you know, when you don't show up at your work, they understandably want to let you go. It just didn't solve anything for me whatsoever. So anyway, fast forward a few years after that, and I suddenly got this desire to go back to school and do something more meaningful with my life. And I can understand now why I was attracted to forensic psychology and why I wanted to become a forensic psychologist. At the time, all I knew was that I felt very strongly that if a person was really sorry for what they did, and if they were willing to be accountable for what they did, then we should work to help that person be rehabilitated and help them come home. So that's how it all began. And then there's been a series of twists and turns, right? I will say that finding restorative justice is probably really like the final step before I fell into advocacy. Because doing restorative justice, which I know we're going to speak about a little later on, doing restorative justice proved to me with my own two eyes the power of conversations between the people who have survived violence and the people who have committed the violence. I was pretty much an atheist prior to finding restorative justice. And then, you know, after that, after seeing and witnessing miracles in real time, I knew I had found the thing that I wanted. Why advocacy though? Well, because quite frankly, I now know so many people in prison who are tremendous people who deserve an opportunity to have a meaningful chance of release to come home. So I think that about sums it up.
Thank you so much for sharing the story, both the horrific part and also the finding your way forward part, which I just want to note to listeners again, happened through your discovery of restorative justice and not through the criminal legal system. I'm going to pause to ask you to define two things for us. The first is restorative justice itself. Some of our listeners may not be completely familiar with what the actual process is of restorative justice that you're referring to and why it would allow you to find such healing and such a way forward. Can you pause for a moment to just describe what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And I will not be able to provide a very succinct definition of restorative justice. There are courses, you know, taught on the topic and many, many, many books. What I'll say for me is that I learned about restorative justice as an Indigenous practice that was created by Indigenous people. It's rooted in cultures that predate us, that inherently understood that when violence has happened, it's the entire community that is impacted. It's not just the people who experienced the violence, though obviously they're at the core, they're at the heart of the issue. But restorative justice recognizes that when violence occurs, it's like tearing a hole in the fabric of the community. And the idea of just removing that person and putting them outside of the community and not addressing the needs of the community as a whole is not healing and is not overall productive. Restorative justice aims to ask the question of what could bring healing to all parties involved. And that includes the person who has committed the violence. Because again, violence happens in a context, and not to excuse it, but rather to ask that person, what is it that you need in order to feel safe enough to not commit violence? I think I would sum up restorative justice in that way. It's like a curiosity, you know?
That's beautiful. Thank you. And accountability also is inherent, right? You can't do restorative justice if you are unable to take accountability for having caused harm. And that's part of, I think, the community orientation is being accountable, not just to the person you harmed, right? But to the impact of your actions on the entire community. It really is such a healing process. Thank you for that. I'm also going to ask you to talk about, before we move on, to talk about your actual work with Drop LWAP, extreme sentences. You know, so you said the presumption is often that a person who has experienced egregious harm, the sort of harm that you experienced, the healing and the feeling of safety is going to come from locking the person up who did that to you for a very, very, very long time. Which would, I think, be an extreme sentence. But I'm wondering if you can talk to us about your definition of what an extreme sentence is. What is it? Have we always had extreme sentences? Is this something that we use a lot of in our criminal legal system? What's the impact in New England of extreme sentences?
Extreme sentencing actually is defined through the research. So luckily, I don't have to try to come up with that one. It's very simply a sentence that is 10 years or longer. And the reason for that, the reason why that is an extreme sentence is because we have gotten used to a culture where they throw decades of incarceration around. You know, they just kind of give it out like, you know, 20 years for you, 40 years for you, 50 years for you. And that has become normalized for us. But from a research perspective, after 10 years of incarceration, there are serious diminishing returns by the year after that. So that's for a couple of reasons. The first reason actually is because we know that people age out of crime. I'm not breaking any news with that. That's the reality. We've actually have 40 years of data plus to back that up, that there is like a peak at which people are going to be involved in crime. Like if they're going to be involved in and be violent, there are certain age categories that are just much higher risk, and that people pretty much their risk drops off precipitously once they hit a certain age. Have we used a lot of extreme sentencing in the United States in general and in New England? Yes, we have. But the key difference between then and now is that people's sentence used to not be reflective of how long they actually served. There's a phenomenon called truth in sentencing. And this is a really big political phenomenon. When presidential candidates started to run on the idea of tough on crime in the late 80s, truth in sentencing also emerged at the same time. I'll give an example. Life without the possibility of parole used to be that a person after, let's say, 20 years or 25 years would have an opportunity to be reviewed. Their sentence was basically, we're not going to put a limit on this sentence because the crime was so horrific or whatnot. We're just going to say that we could potentially keep you in for life. And so that's what the signaling was, that we are not sure that we're ever going to let you out again. When truth in sentencing came around, life without parole became life without the possibility of parole. And when you ask a person, it's interesting, when you ask a person in the community right now, how many years is life without the possibility of parole? They all say 25. And that's reflective of what our culture believes. And if you don't ever have to think about it, then why would you think it's any different? So we have not had, that's the difference. We've had the sentences. We have not had the rigidity around refusing to go back and review somebody's case after an extensive period of time with the possibility of letting people out. The second part of that I would say is very important, which is the political part. Parole board members feel a very intense responsibility for the decisions that they make about letting people out. And that I think is correct, because you should be considering very deeply whether or not somebody is safe to be returned to the community. What is really unnecessary is that when somebody then is not successful at their release, our communities are so risk averse at this point that the person, you know, the people on the parole board get held accountable for that, when that's not the proper place to put your accountability. So then you end up with these parole board members who have said directly to me and many advocates like myself, it will be on my head if that person ends up going back to prison for any reason, including substance use, you know, violation of parole, things like that. And so we have leaned hard into the idea that it is better to be quote unquote safe than sorry. But I argue that that is a false sense of safety, actually, and also just like inhumane and not correct and all these other things.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I will point out to our listeners that, of course, we do not have parole in Maine. And so any life sentence, currently there's about 117, 118 people in prison in Maine serving a life or virtual life sentence, a virtual life sentence being anything over 50 years, who will be in prison the rest of their lives because we do not have parole, period. I'll also point out that when we had sentencing reform in Maine in the 70s and introduced truth in sentencing, the length of sentences in Maine doubled over the next 5 years, doubled. And life sentences prior to sentencing reform usually were somewhere between 10 and 20 years. Nobody served life. And now everybody who gets a life sentence serves life. So it's a dramatic, dramatic, dramatic change here in Maine. I also want to highlight your point that anything after 10 years is considered an extreme sentence. That is the American Bar Association conclusion as well, that sentences over 10 years become counterproductive. Can I ask you what you mean by diminishing returns? What is counterproductive of having a sentence longer than 10 years?
Absolutely. The purpose of incarceration, broadly speaking, is it serves two purposes. The first is safety. If this person has committed violence, it's understandable that people would feel inclined to take them out of the community and put them somewhere where they're being guarded by a lot of people and they can't hurt anybody else in theory anyway. So the first is public safety. The second is rehabilitation. And there is a third that some people believe that the prison system is about retribution, but we're going to leave that sort of over on the side because, to be quite honest, that sort of argument is like a morality argument and it's really hard to like penetrate anybody who, you know, anybody's reasoning about vengeance. That's sort of, that's where they're at in their journey. So we're just going to stick to like the society's purpose for putting people in prison. That second piece of rehabilitation is also very important. So let's say a person is dangerous and they are young enough that they can physically, you know, take out their violence on people. And so we want to remove them from the community. And then we also want to start to talk to them and offer some rehabilitative options in terms of programming and whatnot. After 10 years, the person has pretty much either aged out and or changed. because of their rehabilitating programming. And it costs the community so much money to keep them incarcerated after that point, that now if we've hit our peak of what we can really do with this person in the prison, because there are more opportunities for them in the community to continue their rehabilitation and to be a productive member of community. But if we've hit the peak of what they can do, especially knowing that lifers usually stay in the same facility and they don't see a whole lot of change over those 10 years, that's it. They've kind of maxed out on their potential in that space. Now we're going to talk, you know, now we're saying, okay, let's say it's $70,000 a year to keep a person incarcerated. States vary, you know, and Catherine, you could probably speak to what Maine's cost is. I can tell you in Massachusetts, it's gone up from 70,000 to about 120,000 per person. So if past 10 years, we're keeping them incarcerated and we're waiting for them to die in the case of a life without parole sentence, actually each person costs about $1 million over the course of their lifetime on average. So that's $1 million per person. That's what I mean by diminishing returns. Like, and for what? Because it doesn't add to the safety of the community, and it definitely doesn't do anything further for the rehabilitation, which are the two sole purposes that the prison systems claim that they are for.
Wow, I'm trying to multiply in my head 117, 118 people by million per person, because I think our figures are pretty similar to Massachusetts, and it's a staggering amount. Think what we could do with that money. This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom of Captivity Initiative. And today, I have the great pleasure of talking with Dr. Prashani Reese, who is the ED of DROP LWOP, Drop Life Without Parole, a New England-based nonprofit that advocates against the use of extreme sentences and in favor of hope for those incarcerated with extreme sentences. So, Dr. Reese, let's turn and talk about your actual work with DROP LWOP, with the nonprofit that you head up. How do you go about doing your work? How do you go about trying to intervene in a way that actually shifts public sentiment and the legal landscape?
I think that Brian Stevenson actually really opened my eyes in terms of how do we approach this, when he said that people have to trust you. I think that that's at the core of our message, that where we start in our organization is we start with bringing together the people who are directly impacted by the prison system. So we want to get a sense of all of the people who are inside serving extreme sentences. So we do a tremendous amount of outreach to people who are inside to get a sense of who they are, what programming they've done, what was the story that brought them to prison, because that's, again, context, violence happens in a context. And so to better be able to understand and kind of reaffirm what we already know from the research, which is that everybody has a trauma background, that's what leads them to violence. So we start with the directly impacted inside. We connect to the directly impacted people who are on the outside in the community. According to a research study that was conducted in 2019, I believe, we're estimating now that about 50% of adults in the United States have an immediate family member who has been incarcerated or is currently incarcerated. And the number one thing I hear when I give that stat in a presentation is people say, well, I don't know anybody who's been incarcerated. You said 50%, that's one in two adults. I don't know anybody. And I think that that statement actually leads us to why we then move towards the families of the directly impacted people. Because what it actually is you don't know somebody because they probably haven't disclosed to you. There's a tremendous amount of stigma. And we look for the people in the community who are feeling like they're in a point in their journey where they can start to talk to people about their incarcerated loved one. There's a tremendous amount of shame and a tremendous amount of fear, because oftentimes parents are blamed, for example, when a person has committed a horrific crime, especially mothers. We've known that that's really a thing. So we start there. It's kind of like mobilizing and bringing together the people who are directly impacted and saying amongst that community, hey, would anybody here be willing to talk to stakeholders, legislators, other community groups about their story and about their loved one? Then, of course, the second piece is legislation. We work with legislators in the different state houses in the six New England states to find people who are interested in reducing the prison population for a variety of reasons. Some people for humane reasons, other people for fiscal reasons. And we look for those advocates in those state houses to try to get opportunities to talk to community leaders who really have the power to change things about different ways and ideas in which we could reduce the prison population. And then third, I think, is really trying to get out to the community and educate. Then we bring all of that together, right? We have our directly impacted people. We have the most obvious stakeholders, but then the third and most difficult piece actually of all of this is that the United States has a culture of eye for eye justice. That's what normalcy is. When you think about crime and punishment, you know, people say, well, why should these people get a second chance? The person who is dead doesn't get a second chance. That is the number one response that I hear. And it made me stop and think a couple years into this work. I went, wow, that's so different than what the rest of the world thinks of in terms of crime and punishment. And it's also an incredibly black and white way of thinking about it. But those are the three things that we're up against. And like you said earlier, easy peasy.
Right, just get it done. You know, to your first point, it really struck me because when I was starting the Freedom in Captivity Initiative in 2019, 2020, launched in 2021, that was a public humanities initiative to envision an abolitionist future in Maine. And I was very interested in getting lots of cultural and arts organizations involved in the initiative. And so I crisscrossed the state meeting with creatives, cultural producers, artistic producers, writers, a whole bunch of different categories of professional expertise, and including a lot of people that I had known for years. And I was shocked at how many people revealed to me for the first time that their brother was incarcerated, their cousin was incarcerated, their dad was in, people they'd known for years who had never, ever, ever brought this up, because why would they? And suddenly, when we're doing a project specifically about, you know, our prisons, the answer, person after person after person revealing this to me, it was shattering, actually, to look around my tiny little community in Maine and realize how many of us have been impacted by incarceration in ways that we have never acknowledged to each other. So thank you for making that point. I really agree with that. I'm curious how things are going in Massachusetts, which is where you're based. The Supreme Court, as you know, of course, and I want to make sure our listeners understand, the Supreme Court ruled against LWOP for juveniles. And that caused the states around the country to begin releasing people who had been given life sentences when they were, if they were, had been under 18 at the time of their crime. And so Massachusetts is among those, has released a number of people who were given life sentences when they were under the age of 18. We've interviewed some of them for this program. I'm wondering if you could talk to us about how it's gone. What's the result? You know, was there a massive uptick in violence all over Massachusetts because people who had committed egregious violence when they were 16, 17 years old were now being let out of prison as a 40-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 50-year-old? How is it going? And what has been happening in Massachusetts to ensure that there's some kind of support for folks who have spent time inside since they were children being released as adults?
I want to add just another legal piece so that our listeners understand, not to be like dry about all of this, but you mentioned, you know, the Supreme Court and their Miller v. Alabama decision back in 2012. What they specifically said was that you cannot mandatorily sentence a person under the age of 18 to life without the possibility of parole. And the reason that's important is because that means that other states have reacted differently to Massachusetts. Not everybody then got on board with that. So what Massachusetts did in their Diachenko decision in 2014 was they took the Supreme Court's decision one step further and they abolished it entirely. Whereas in other states have just set up their sentencing phase to be more like a capital punishment phase of the trial. So once a person is found guilty, now they're saying, okay, a person can't be mandatorily sentenced, but I'm going to go make the case that this juvenile is a monster who's beyond rehabilitation. And I'm going to try to convince a jury or a judge that the appropriate sentence for this 16-year-old is life without the possibility of parole. I just want to name that because of the six New England states, Massachusetts is judicially the most progressive of the six. And I specify judicially because we've had to have the courts make these decisions where our legislators have not been able to make those decisions. What we know about the lifers who have come home so far, and I can't wait for somebody to actually get enough data to be able to put out research about this, because it's a relatively new phenomenon, you know, without, you know, few years of data combined with trying to capture as many of those JLWAPs, that's what we call them, juvenile life without parolers. We can't say yet from a research perspective, but I can speak from an anecdotal perspective and also what I have witnessed in the community and what I hear from others in the community. If you are a JLWAP and you took somebody's life under the age of 18 years old and you are being released as a 40-year-old man, 50-year-old person, 6-year-old person, whatnot, you are not going back to prison and you are not hurting anybody. I make this point when I talk from a forensic psychology perspective. For those people who don't understand, a key component of forensic psychology is assessing dangerousness and whether or not somebody should be released. And I make this point all the time, which is, give me the 50-year-old man who killed somebody when he was 20 years old, who has no record of violence in the prison or very little record of violence in the prison, maybe when he was initially incarcerated, has a family support system on the outside, and I will stake my life on him coming back to the community and never committing violence again. But it's interesting that if you give me the 24-year-olds, notice that it's under the age of brain development at 26. If you give me the 24-year-old who is gang involved, substance use addicted, doesn't have great family supports on the outside, is only in prison for an assault, they haven't killed anybody yet, and I'm not going anywhere near that, like theoretically, in terms of like whether I'm not going to make any bets about if that person can come home safely. So it's the reverse of what people often think. People often think if you've killed somebody, you are more risky to be released. When in actuality, if somebody appears to be on the road to killing somebody, but they haven't yet, they haven't gone that step yet, we give them these short sentences, and then we're surprised when they return to the community and whatnot. Just a quick note, I'm not advocating for longer sentences. I would say the fix to that is many more systems support, and that prison is not the appropriate place to put that 24-year-old who's probably going in there with their fellow gang members where they're just going to continue their gang rivalries together. So I'm not advocating for longer sentences, but I'm advocating for more help for those people inside, while also trying to say to the community, you have this role reversal, actually, about the way we think about who's dangerous and who's not.
Thank you so much. We are at time. And so I want to thank you so much for joining the program and sharing so much of your wisdom and experience and knowledge, as well as your personal story with us. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, to Aaron Pyle, who's our sound engineer, and Daria Cullen, who's our executive producer. I'm Catherine Besteman. We are Justice Radio.